Hello, everybody, and welcome to I Eat Green. I am so happy to be with you here on this beautiful Thursday morning, and I have a wonderful show planned for you today. My guests will be Heather Forrest and Larry Foglia from the Long Island Agriculture Network and Fox Hollow Farms, and they'll be coming on in a little while. But first, I want to share with you some events going on in the city and some things in the news and some actions that I want to ask all of you to take. The first action, obviously, is against the Monsanto Dark Act. For those of you that are not aware, right now there's a bill in Congress to make it illegal for states to develop their own mandatory labeling policies. And this bill would make it a national law that companies can voluntarily label GMOs if they want to, but they don't have to. And it is, you know, being pushed by Monsanto and the American Grocery Association. And it is just a horrible bill that will keep all of us in the dark as to what foods we're really eating, and that's why it's being called the Dark Act. And on my website, there is an opportunity for you to sign a petition. You can also call your congressman and let them know that you want them to reject that bill. And it's really, really important. So please go onto my website. There's a link there where you can find out the phone number of your congressman, who to call. You can also find out how your congressman voted on the House bill. This bill actually passed through the House. Now it's going through the Senate. And we have to stop it in its tracks. It's really bad for the country. It's bad for our children. It's for our families. It's bad all the way around. So please take action with that. Also, I guess I'm sure you've heard about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That's a treaty, basically, that has been being negotiated behind closed doors between corporations, President Obama, and it has been really not even open to Congress and to the people. So it's been being negotiated behind closed doors. It's now coming out and being voted on. And it is really, really not good. This treaty has in it opportunities for imports and exports for them to set up laws that will prevent us from exporting our goods to other countries or importing goods. If we have GMO products that we want to export and the country doesn't want them, this law will force them to either take our products or have to, or they might be sued by the corporation. The corporation will be able to sue countries for lost profit, potentially lost profit. It's really just a horrible law, and it's going to take many jobs overseas that should be kept here. It's just really not good for our country, and the way they're spinning it makes it look like it's a good thing, but it's really not. So take a look at that. There's also a petition to sign that. And the other one is also a Prescription Drug Affordability Act that I want to raise your awareness about. I mean, you maybe have heard about the PharmaPro, the 32-year-old guy who bought one drug and then, you know, overnight went from $13.50 a pill to $750 a pill. Or the pharmaceutical company, Valeant Pharmaceuticals, that was just written about in New York Times. They also have raised all of their prices like 66% this year, and one drug, they actually quadrupled it. And the prices of pharmaceuticals, I mean, just look at, you know, so many businesses are struggling, but if you look around, what businesses are really booming, and you see that there's a new pharmacy on almost every corner. It's just crazy. And you look at TV and you just see all the advertisements for pharmaceuticals. Well, you know how much money they're spending on those advertisements. So they just have way too much money and they're ripping us off, and the push for medicines is just really over the top. And so, you know, I love when I have the opportunities to celebrate food as medicine. But right now, I want to raise awareness about these drugs. And I would like you all to sign the petition to put in place some sort of cap on how these pharmaceutical companies can raise their prices and some limit on the profits that they can make, because it's just really over the top. So those are some ways you can take action. I also talked about Coca-Cola recently and all the money that they've been investing in trying to spin, you know, spin the obesity problem as not a problem of sugar, but as a problem of not enough exercise. And it's actually come out this week that Coca-Cola has been funding over $3 million this year alone, the Pediatric Association, the American Pediatric Association. They funded $3 million for the website, and they continuously give money to the American Pediatric Association, even though the Pediatric Association has said that sugary drinks have added to the obesity epidemic and is not good for our children. They've been in cahoots together. So anyway, I think finally the American Pediatric Association, now that it's become public, is rejecting them and is going to break off their ties. But the kind of partnership that they have is the kind of partnership that exists all over the place of good companies taking funding from not-so-good companies who just want to spin their support in a way that, I guess it's to relieve their guilt of what they're doing that's wrong. But anyway, it's always, you know, even conferences that I'm a part of, it's always a question, you know, if we get, where do we get our money from? It costs a lot of money to put on a conference, and if you have Miracle-Gro offering you money, you know, do you take the money from Miracle-Gro, or do you hold to your standards and say, no, we have to find somewhere else to get our money? It's really a tough question. You know, this past year I had gone to a conference, and actually Pepsi was there, and another company was there too. But Pepsi has started this company that's going around to bodegas and bringing fresh fruits and vegetables while they deliver their Coke, which is adding to the obesity epidemic. They're also delivering fresh vegetables because they have the ability to get to all these little bodegas. And, you know, it's a question. They're trying to do something good while they're doing something bad. And does that negate the good? It's just a question. Just putting it out there. Okay. Lots of things are going on in and around the city this week and next couple of weeks. October 15th through the 18th is the New York City Wine and Food Festival going on throughout the city. Go onto their website to find out the specifics. The Long Island Food Coalition is having their second farm tour. The first one was four different farms on the north shore of Long Island in Nassau County. This will be on the south shore of Nassau County, and it's going to start off in Long Beach and end in Long Beach at the Long Beach Kennedy Plaza. We'll be going to four different farms. This is a chartered bus event. The first stop will be Crossroads Farm at Grossman's, although we first will start at the farmer's market at the Kennedy Plaza. Then we'll go to Grossman's Farm. Then we'll go to the Baldwin Organic Garden Share, and then the Nike Alternative School Garden. The last farm tour was a great success, and I'm sure this one will be too. The cost is $50 per person or $90 for two, and you can go to the Long Island Food Coalition's website or my website to find out information to be able to buy tickets. October 17th is also another great event. This one's free. It's being sponsored by the North Shore Land Alliance, and it's a walk in the woods, and it's taking place at Dwarf Pine Plains in West Hampton. Go on to the North Shore Land Alliance website to sign up for this, but it is a free event, and you know, their walks are always really wonderful, and I recommend them. Food and Water Watch is having their 10th anniversary benefit on October 19th at a restaurant at 186 Franklin Street in Manhattan at 5 p.m. And you can go to Food and Water Watch website to buy their tickets. Excuse me. October 31st is a harvest dinner at Chin Estate Vineyards. that is a biodynamic farm or vineyard out in Matatuck on Long Island. Great, great vineyard. The people that run it are wonderful, and it's a multi-course dinner paired with new vintages and old vintages. And it's to be a lot of fun with harvest stories and locally inspired creations. So if you would like to join that, you can find out more information also on my website or go to Shin Estate Vineyards for more information. November 1st through 8th is Long Island Restaurant Week. You can take advantage of that with lots of great restaurants. November 5th, Edible Escape is having a trip to Brooklyn. I guess this is being sponsored by Edible Brooklyn. So you can go onto their website for that. The Naval Expo is coming, the Naval Expo Long Island, on November 8th. I'm not sure where that is, but go to the website of the Naval Expo and you can find out more information about that. Okay. I would like to share my recipe with you. If you can hear, I have a bit of a cold, and this recipe is always, you know, it's like a vegetarian chicken soup. It's a miso vegetable chowder. Really easy to make, very quick, and I just, you know, I have it for breakfast, lunch, and dinner when I'm sick, and it really, you know, within a day, I'm feeling so much better. I'm so much better today than I was yesterday, so by tomorrow I'll be perfect again, I'm sure. So start with 8 cups of water, 5 cloves of garlic, a 2-inch or 3-inch piece of ginger, 1 organic onion that you're going to chop into slivers, 1 organic carrot washed and chopped into nice chunks, 1 organic celery washed and chopped, 1 organic broccoli cut into florets, 6 tablespoons of white or red miso. I actually use like 3 tablespoons of each, and 1 8-ounce package of soba or udon noodles. And you're going to cook those separately according to the directions, a little al dente. And you just add a little at the bottom of each bowl before you serve the soup. So in a large pot, you're going to saute the onions and carrots. Oh, and if you also have burdock root, you can put in some burdock root in this. And you can saute those in olive oil for about 5 minutes. And let me also just say that you don't even have to saute these. Sometimes I just throw it right into the pot and skip that and just go right into the pot of water. If you're not vegetarian, you can use a tablespoon of bonito flakes as well. The bonito flakes you can put into a tea ball. And bonito flakes are dried fish flakes, available in most Japanese stores and in Whole Foods. You can certainly get them. And you put the bonito flakes into a tea ball, or you wrap it in some cheesecloth tied with a string, and you can add that to the pot of water. But I didn't do that in this pot of soup that I made yesterday, and it's still delicious. So you add water to the pot along with the tea ball with bonito flakes and bring that to a boil. Reduce the heat and let it simmer for 20 minutes. Add the remaining vegetables, and you can also add some tofu if you'd like. And then also you can add some wakame, which is seaweed. And if you want to add wakame, wakame is dried seaweed, and you want to reconstitute it first. So boil a little water, reconstitute the wakame in a little bowl, and then you can add the wakame to the soup also and cook that for another 10 minutes. To add the miso, what you're going to do is you're going to put the miso into a little bowl. You're going to ladle some of the broth into the bowl and dissolve the miso in the bowl first, and dissolve out those 6 tablespoons of miso in the little bowl, then add the bowl back into the pot. Once you add the miso in, you don't want to boil the soup because that ruins the medicinal value of the miso. So you want to just, it can be hot, but you don't want to boil it once you've added the miso. And then, as I said before, you take the noodles and you put a little bit of the noodles into the bowl. Then you add the soup, and that's it. It's delicious, it's quick, and the soup and the noodles can be stored separately in the refrigerator and can be heated up. And each time that you heat it up, remember not to boil the soup if you've already added the miso. You can also, if you make a big pot of this, you can add the miso just to the part that you're eating. You can even add the miso to each individual bowl and keep the broth without the miso in it so that you can bring it back to a boil if you like your soup really hot. So all that is available up on my website. It will also be on the PRN website. by later today. Okay, so now it's my pleasure to introduce two of Long Island's most active farmers, Heather Forrest and Larry Foglia. They are dear friends of mine since we work in so many ways together. They have been involved in the local farm and food movement for over 30 years. They both have their own separate careers, but together they were founding members of the Long Island Agricultural Network, and they also helped to establish Gateway Community Garden here in Huntington Station. Heather is also a storyteller, author, musician, and executive director of Story Arts, and Larry is a natural resource consultant and environmental educator. So Larry and Heather, are you with me?
Yes, we are.
We are.
Great. Welcome. I'm so glad you could join me today. So, how are you both?
We're fine. A little bit under the weather like you, but now that I have your recipe, I'm going to have a speedy recovery, I guess.
Good. You will. It's so good. So, can you just share with us a little bit of your background? Like, have you always been interested in farming, or when did that start for you?
Well, my parents are from Queens originally, and they decided to buy a small farm in Nassau County when I was a toddler, and moved my father's parents nearby there. So we grew up, or my sisters and I grew up on a little farm in Nassau County, preserving vegetables on wood fires outside, growing. We had 18 different kinds of fruit. My parents were in academia, but they always had a lifestyle of having a farm and growing a good deal of the food we ate. And I guess osmotically we absorbed how to do things on a farm. It was part of our lives as kids and continued when we moved from a farm in Nassau County to a farm in Huntington. It's part of our lives. We raised our children. Heather and I raised our children on land next door to my parents, so we've always had a family farm with multi-generations on the farm.
Oh, that's so great. And has it always been organic?
Well, just to finish, Heather's interest in farming, I guess, started in the early 70s when she moved to an estate, lived in a chicken coop, actually, on an estate, and the people that owned the estate were avid gardeners and farmers, and she pitched right in there. And fortunately for her, she married a farmer in the early 80s, me.
Uh-huh. So
good choice.
My roots in farming go deep into this ground, and osmosis is an interesting concept. By just living an agricultural lifestyle where our days are organized around being indoors or outdoors, depending on the season, depending on the work in the garden or on the farm, organizes life in a perspective that's connected to nature in a way that's different than if a person works in an office or buys all of their food in the grocery store. By growing our own food, we're very connected to the cycles of nature.
That's so lucky. can you imagine if more people had that opportunity? But thanks to both of you, you're actually giving more people that opportunity because you're such great community organizers and doers that you've really been spreading your passion and helping getting farms going. Can you share with us the forming of the Long Island Community Agricultural Network that you were so instrumental in starting?
Well, we've always been involved in different socio-political activity. Even before demonstrating against the Vietnam War or working on environmental issues, Earth Day, the original Earth Day, Heather and I met doing Heather did a performance, a grant-funded performance to celebrate the 10th anniversary of Earth Day, and we worked together on that. So there's always been a history of community activism, and our parents were always that way. And I think it's by our nature that if we know something that's valuable to other people, we feel obligated to share it, especially as we get older. That's how knowledge is passed on. So Long Island Community Agriculture Network started just by another person, Fran Whittlesey, and I kind of bumped into each other after having done activism in the past relative to community-wide recycling. Asked each other what we were doing, and she was working on issues with homeless, and I was working on gardening and farming issues. And she said, well, you know, let's do something together. And we met around our magic kitchen table, and Heather is the coalescer of ideas and energy. And we put together the Long Island Community Agriculture Network and decided to give people access to land and teach them how to grow vegetables.
We came up with a very simple mission, which turns out to be a lot more complex than it sounds. The Long Island Community Agriculture Network is dedicated to connecting people to land, gardening skills, and fresh locally grown food, which of course requires a level of access to land that not everybody has. So logical extensions of that mission seem to include creating opportunities for people, especially in low-income areas or in areas where there are not easily accessible situations to obtain organic vegetables, to help those people have access to land to grow their own, and then teaching people how to maximize their produce in small spaces would be a secondary goal. But the first step was to create an opportunity to have access to land, and that's how the Gateway Community Garden was formed.
For years, we attended the New England Environmental Conference, which drew at Tufts University, the Lincoln Filene Center at Tufts University, and that drew activists and environmentalists from all over the world. And we participated in an environmental leadership training program there. And what we saw at conferences like that was that these ideas are out there. The models are out there. It's just that for different reasons, Long Island is a little behind sometimes in what's going on in other places, but it's easy to take an existing model and bring it to Long Island. If it's a good idea, it's easy to find people that jump on the bandwagon and realize that it's a great idea. So the community garden model is out there. There are wonderful community gardens all over the country, and all of the information on how to do it is available on the internet. You just have to take the concepts and the strategies and learn how to implement them in your own community. And that's what we decided to do. Figure out how to implement the community garden model in appropriate communities. We started with Huntington, and we're participating in the same concepts promulgated in other parts of Long Island. It's really catching on.
Uh-huh. What were some of the biggest challenges in getting the community garden going?
It's sometimes difficult to work with municipalities and political organizations that have ingrained ways of doing things, and you're bringing something new to them. And it's not that it's difficult, but they're cautious. They're understandably cautious. So one has to I was always used to working on construction projects where things had to be done as quickly and as efficiently as possible. You have to work a bit more slowly with the town, and once they got on board and realized that it's an absolutely wonderful thing, then things happen very quickly. You just have to understand the caution that they have to take because of the nature of a municipality.
Right.
And so once those challenges were done, things moved extremely quickly. And we thought it would be difficult to get the community on board, but that, you know, once you put the word out and people realize that you're somebody that you can trust and realize that their energy is going to be part of the process and everybody's going to be working together, then, again, things move much more quickly and they stay there because people create it with you. They created
right.
it themselves. It's kind of a servant leadership model.
Uh-huh. And if you build it, they will come, right?
No, it's not they build it and they will. They realize they're participating in building it and they will come and work on
uh-huh.
it. It's like it doesn't work if you build it and expect people to come. It's not theirs.
Right, right.
If
so they built it.
Part of the community is involved in the design and that their opinions are weighed in, then the more ownership they take and the more, for it and the more responsibility they exhibit to maintain it.
Mm-hmm. A good example
one of the
that
remarkable
was
things
the fact
I saw
Larry designed wonderful handicapped accessible beds that had a panel 2 feet by 20 feet long on the sides, raising the planting area up enough so that someone could be in a walker or even a wheelchair and still have the ability to work a raised bed. And teasingly, we were told, oh, well, before you turn around, those big pieces of open space will be covered with graffiti. So I thought, well, let's preempt that and paint them with something useful, like murals. And that's how the mural project got started, with a grant through Story Arts from the New York State Council for the Arts. We created, in partnership with LICAN, a painting project that Luciene Pereira, who is a Brazilian mural artist and lives in our community, has done a few other murals since in the town of Huntington, designed, and with the assistance of Susan Gaber and 70 people in the neighborhood, built this incredible visual statement, which one of the billboards that are, there are five murals altogether now, one is a billboard that describes beneficial bugs, and the other side of it is a planting calendar that shows graphically, without words but with diagrams by the month, what to plant where and when. And then the handicap beds have long murals on them. One tells the story of how a bean grows. Another tells the story of pollination and metamorphosis. Another describes the understory, the roots of the different kinds of vegetables that grow in the countries and cultures of the multicultural neighborhood that was brought together over this project. Even little tiny toddlers painting with their fingers dipped in yellow paint helped to do some of the flowers on the murals. They've been there for a while, and there's no graffiti. People love them because they made them.
Right, right. It's a great, great idea. And I've been there, and it's beautiful. And one of the things that stands out to me from that community garden is how it's brought the different communities together. You know, the location where you are, you know, is right next to like a project, and on the other side is a gated community of, you know, commuters to Manhattan. So, and it seems like it's really been a beautiful coming together of different socioeconomic and cultural experiences. Can you share some of that with us?
Generational as well.
What was that?
Intergenerational activities abound
yeah.
there as well. There's a children's garden, and we've done children's programming there as well. So the place is filled with people from different cultures and different ages and different neighborhoods working together. In a community garden, you all share the same sky, and bugs jump from one bed to the other. So people need to be aware of how to work as a community in a community garden.
Uh-huh.
The interesting thing about gardening
when
is...
When Huntington gave you that space, it was for a temporary time period. Has that changed, or are they going? Have they decided to let the garden stay, or are you going to have to move the garden at some point?
Well, nothing happens quickly in town. They
right?
seem to enjoy having the garden there. We made the garden beds so that if we had to move them, we could move them.
The land around
it is being acquired by the town, and they're developing a children's nature play area that we had in our original plan, And then it's been suggested by Mark McAteer, a local landscape architect, to develop a whole environmental awareness area there, even utilizing a recharge basin that always has water in it as a nature observation area. So I got a feeling it's going to be there for a while, but you can have a community garden on any piece of land as long as you have sun and access to water. So if we had to move those beds, we could. We designed them in such a way that if we had to move them, it wouldn't be a difficult task.
The most important thing that we've learned from this endeavor is community involvement at the beginning is essential, and then the community needs to own it at the end. The Gateway Community Garden is now its own not-for-profit with a garden council, has taken over the leadership of the garden, and the gardeners themselves are making the rules and creating the distribution systems of who gets what bed, and it's an independent launched project. So as far as we can tell, that's one measure of success. It doesn't need us anymore.
They've also learned that they're empowered to negotiate with the town. I just came back from a meeting this morning where we had representatives from the Parks Department and the General Services Department talking to the gardeners about how the gardeners need the town to help them maintain this site. So you go from people who think they don't have a voice in town to people who are taking responsibility for a part of the town and understanding what it is to deal with the different offices in the town, to work together to keep things the way they would like them to be. And so it's a very empowering scenario.
That is, you know, amazing and wonderful. I mean, I did not even know that they were standing on their own like that now. And that is great to see that it's actually been launched and that it's a self-running garden now. That's wonderful. Congratulations.
Well, thank
you. Really
happy
to hear that. You're involved in so many other projects. I want to take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I'd like to hear about some of the other projects that you're involved in, including the Grow to Give project, okay? So don't go anywhere. Everyone listening, you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green, and my guests, Heather Forrest and Larry Foglia. Be right back.
Stay tuned to PRN.FM for more empowering ideas from progressive voices. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Why would anyone ride on top of an elevator, lug around an 11-pound large print dictionary, or compete in a swim race unable to see the course? Well, this is me, and I've got some riveting experiences to share with you. Hey, I'm Mark Farrell. Join me for Insight, a new show coming to PRN.FM. It's about overcoming adversity, and who doesn't experience this in some capacity? I'm no doctor, but I'm an expert in me since I've been dealing with various forms of adverse conditions all my life, like having a rare visual disability that challenges much of what I do. Insight, real-life issues, including mental health, anxiety, depression, suicide, drugs, and alcohol. Celebrity guests will also reveal on Insight how they overcame adversity to make it, as well as your calls on challenges you struggle with. My difference makes me stronger. That's my mantra. Listen and discover how your difference makes you stronger. Insight, Thursdays at 11 a.m. only on PRN.FM.
Hi, I'm Sandy Leon Best, host of Political Analysis. Welcome to the 21st century, where the corporate propaganda machine works 24-7 to manufacture your reality. Every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, Political Analysis challenges the corporate narrative with independent news, analysis, and passionate conversations on the most critical issues of our time. Don't let the corporate echo machine become your truth. Tune in live to Political Analysis or visit the archives at PRN.FM. If you like the show, rate us in iTunes. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
You're listening to PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm here with Heather Forrest and Larry Foglia from the Gateway Community Gardens and the Long Island Agriculture Network and Fox Hollow Farm. Hi, Larry and Heather.
Hi there.
Hi there.
Hi. So right before our break, I wanted to touch base with you about this Grow to Give project that you both started. Can you tell us about that and what you're doing with that?
In 2012, the Martin Luther King Prayer Service, which takes place every year in Huntington, it's an ecumenical interfaith event that takes place on Martin Luther King's birthday and is dedicated to a different social justice issue, had the agenda and title, We Can End Childhood Hunger. And because the theme was around ending childhood hunger, the organizers thought, well, let's have, instead of a sermon, a story teller come and do that part of the service. And so they called me up and said, would I come and tell stories about food for the We Can End Childhood Hunger version of the Martin Luther King Prayer Service. And I said, that's great. I'm very in support of the concept, and I certainly would love to know, how do you intend to end childhood hunger? And the organizer said, well, we're going to pray. And I said, well, that's wonderful. And what are you going to do to end childhood hunger? And I was told, well, we are going to raise awareness about the fact that there are many hungry children in our town. And I said, well, that's wonderful, but what are you going to do? How about as well as raising awareness of food equity issues and childhood hunger in our town, how about if you raise vegetables? And the suggestion was taken absolutely seriously and extended to designing an outreach at that event, which brought about 500 people together and many congregations in town, to the concept that maybe it would be possible to dig up lawns on congregational property and plant gardens, vegetable gardens that would be tended by congregants, and the food that would be raised there would then be donated to local food pantries. And that's how the Grow to Give garden project started, as a result of that prayer service and the outreach that followed it. 10 congregations in the Huntington Township dug up lawns and started to plant vegetables. We got a grant from the Long Island Community Foundation and the Horace and Amy Hagedorn Foundation to help those synagogues and churches to grow food. Just because you have land and a desire doesn't necessarily mean you have the knowledge. So we trained mentors to help the houses of worship that needed help in the gardening aspect. And the first year, 2,035 pounds of fresh produce was donated to the local food pantries in Huntington. The participants were wide range: Temple Bethel, St. Hugh of Lincoln Roman Catholic Church, St. John's Episcopal Church, Huntington Jewish Center, Dix Hills Methodist Church, Bethany Presbyterian, Suffolk Y Jewish Community Center, Gehillah Shalom, the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. And in order to expand it beyond our town, part of the grant was that we would write a manual about how to start a service garden at a church or synagogue. And it's online, if anybody wants to take a look at it, on the lifeham.org website on the homepage. LICAN.org. There's a little video that is kind of a very short description of the program that people can use to encourage their own congregation to participate. And then there's a manual that talks about how to go about organizing your project. It's a downloadable PDF that was developed as a result of this project from our experience. And we've had feedback from all over. I've heard from friends from other parts of the country that have seen this and said, oh, well, we have a lawn at our synagogue or our church or our mosque. Why are we taking care of a non-productive green carpet instead of growing food for food pantries, which receive less than 10% in most cases fresh vegetables? It's something that is important for the health of young children to eat nutritious vegetables. And if you're poor and can't afford to buy food and need to rely on the resources of a food pantry, then as a right, why isn't everyone entitled to have nutritious food? So if there's a way to contribute to that food stream by using land that's otherwise just decorative, it's just a great idea. People have embraced it, and they're starting to do it, growing to give. We also like to encourage home gardeners to grow one extra row of anything in their gardens and donate it to a local food pantry. If there's a national movement called Plant a Row, if everybody in the country planted one extra row in their garden, there would be a lot of food in the food pantries that would be fresh and nutritious and green.
Yeah, that's a great idea. There's Ample Harvest. Do you know that organization? Ample Harvest, I think, is an organization where you can find a local online, find a local food pantry that will accept your vegetables. I mean, although I'm sure people know a lot of places around here, but it's like a networking of, you know, people that have certain vegetables that can bring them to different places. So that's a good website too, Ample Harvest.
Some food pantries are not equipped to take produce, but when they find that the produce will be available, they will often equip themselves with the necessary refrigeration because they realize themselves the nutritional value of fresh, organically grown food, which actually gets to the food pantry probably 2 weeks earlier than organic produce gets to the average grocery store, because it's harvested one day and it's available to the consumer the next day, as opposed to the produce in a grocery store generally has to go to a warehouse and then get redistributed from a warehouse, which takes time itself. And the more time after something is picked before it's consumed, the lower the nutritional value of that produce.
One of the ways that people could investigate where they could bring their extra produce would be to communicate with the food pantry to find out when the food share actually takes place and bring the food that's fresh at the time of distribution. So they don't have to store it. Or locally on Long Island, there's a wonderful organization, Food Not Bombs. They have a website, and they have food shares that are kind of pop-up food shares in several towns throughout Long Island that attract donators right then to the distribution time. In Huntington, it's on Tuesday nights at 7 o'clock on Fairview Street.
Right, and by me, it's on Sunday afternoon around 2 o'clock. So I sometimes go over there and bring food. Anytime I have leftover food from a party or anything, I hand that out there. And it is a wonderful organization. I've had John on my radio show before.
We have some houses of worship that were very enthusiastic about participating in the Grow to Give program, but didn't have appropriate site at their churches or synagogues to actually grow vegetables. So by choice, they registered for some beds at some community gardens and their volunteers use those spaces to grow vegetables at a community garden, and then those vegetables are given to food pantries, and it encourages other people in the community gardens who can often grow a lot more than they need themselves to contribute to local food pantries. Gateway Garden regularly brings food down to the Food Not Bombs on Tuesday nights, which is literally right up the road from the garden.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's great. And the other thing that's so nice about the Grow to Give project is synagogues have built in people that are looking to do community service work. You know, I'm always getting calls from, you know, people who are looking to do community service work, and they know that I do it, so they're calling to see when they can plug in. And this is just a wonderful way that they can have immediate, you know, take immediate action and feel like they're doing something. So it's great.
A big part of the manual talks about, you know, you can get volunteers to do things, but there are steps that you have to take to coalesce that energy and maintain the flow of that energy once you start a project. So that's an important part. You need to find funding, and you need to find the volunteers and the energy, and you need some administrative skills to keep that going.
Yeah, I would think so, because a lot of times people start with a lot of energy and then it kind of peters out.
Exactly. Somebody has to be the hub, or a number of people have to be the hub to keep it going. And then, you know, it can develop as it did at the community gardens with an independent, you know, energy source and a system to run the whole thing. But it does take some organizational efforts to make that happen, especially initially.
We found that a partnership between someone who is knowledgeable in gardening and someone who's knowledgeable in organizational leadership is a good team.
And an awareness of the fact that it's going to take some funding, either grant-supported funding or contributive funding on the part of the congregation. It's very easy to make people feel guilty, as Heather said, about having lawns where you can be growing vegetables.
Uh-huh. Right.
If you're not taking care of the lawn, you save money.
True.
Lawns are expensive, and they have a tremendously negative environmental impact, whereas taking that same lawn and making it into a productive vegetable garden is something that creates a positive flow.
So true. So true. Well, I have a big lawn here, if you know anyone who wants to garden it. I mean, I have a big garden, but I'm actually looking for people to dig up my front lawn and do some work there. So if you know of anybody who wants to take my front yard on, please let me know.
We had an interesting invitation a few years back. A local yoga studio where I had been studying had a director with a very, very big backyard and decided that the best kind of yoga practice that could extend from the studio into the world at large was to turn her backyard into a community garden for the yoga students. So yoga through gardening ended up being the Lotus Garden, and that garden had a design that was based on the needs of the people who were participating. So everybody had their own individual plots, but there was also an area where people learned how to work in community. So there were group areas where people worked together, but they shared the melons, etc. And then there were areas designed into the garden that were grow-to-give areas, so that part of the process of being in that garden was to tending one's own needs, tending to the needs of the community, and then tending to the needs of those beyond the community in the larger sphere.
Uh-huh.
School gardens
are
another wonderful way that the garden can stretch into the lifestyle of the community that decides to do it. We recently built 5 beds at the school down the street from Gateway Community Garden. It's a science, technology, engineering, and math school, the Jack Abrams School. And last year we helped them start their community, club, a garden club. And this year they decided to extend that so that the garden actually took place at their school in their courtyard. So we built a bunch of beds for them, and they integrated the growing of vegetables into their science curriculum.
Uh-huh. And Larry, you were also involved in starting a gardening program at a camp, right, at USDAN, a local arts camp, which you think of as, you know, just the arts, and now it also has a whole agricultural aspect to it. Can you share with us about that? Is Larry there? Hello?
Yes.
Larry?
Yes. The garden.
Hi, I wanted you to share with us about USDAN.
USDAN is a music and art camp in South Huntington area, in the Melville, actually Dix Hills area. And I had started a nature program there 16 years ago, thematically organized that nature has always been inspirational to art and music. And then there started to be this national organic gardening movement, and some kids kind of expressed interest in doing that. So the camp wisely said, let's find a place where we can have a garden program. When we found, we're a very wooded 200 acres of woods, but we did come up with a really nice area for a terraced garden, and put some energy into finding the right staff that had some knowledge of gardening and of working with children with gardens, and it has just absolutely mushroomed. The level of enthusiasm that kids have for gardening and learning how to create simple food from the things that they grow in their garden and they nurture from seed to food that can go on a table or in a salad and in a soup
is just
absolutely wonderful. So,
So how long has that gardening program been going on now?
That's been going on probably for about 6 or 7 years.
And how many kids do they have in that program?
It's organized, the camp is organized with majors and minors. The majors are there for 2 hours and the minors for an hour. So with the overlap, there's probably about 30 children involved
so
at least sometime during the day. It's about 1,700 kids at the camp altogether. There's about 75 who participate in the nature program.
Uh-huh. That's wonderful. That's great. So you've also used these gardens as opportunities to work with people with emotional and mental challenges. Can you share with us how you've got started with that and how you're using the gardens to help these kids and adults?
Here at Fox Hollow Farm, we've built a group of dedicated beds for the North Shore Child and Family Guidance Center's teens. They are a group of severely emotionally challenged teens who were benefiting from wilderness experiences, and a few years ago stopped by. This was a group based in Roslyn. They stopped by here on their way to Comsit, and we gave them a farm tour and a tasting tour and looking at vegetables, and the kids were so excited about it, they wanted to come back the next week. Well, it evolved into a program and partnership that Fox Hollow Farm has with the North Shore Child and Family Guidance Center, and we have been, for the last 3 or 4 years, working with these teens in this particular area of the farm where they grow the vegetables, nurture them through the season, and the food is for their use and for donation, so there's an opportunity to give back to the community. The gardens themselves are utilized from a psychological point of view as a metaphor. The tomato cages that are supporting the tomatoes help those tomatoes grow, and just like those tomatoes, everybody has support systems. We're able to use what happens in the garden conversationally to talk about life. And the children who are participating are especially challenged in terms of attention, working together, and interpersonal communication. None of those challenges they're not part of what we see when we're working with the kids in the garden. They help each other. They communicate well. They listen to instructions. They're enthusiastic. They're outside, and they have smiles on their faces. And many of them are here because they're severely depressed in other contexts.
Uh-huh.
So one of our biggest excitements this past year was they hand planted 600 feet of corn, one seed at a time, and then through the season, in a larger field beyond their dedicated beds, raised beds, and then they took care of that corn and hilled it so that the corn could have anchor roots, and then at the end of the season,
about 80 days later, after they planted their corn,
right, we had a corn party where we brought. We cooked the corn outside on a camp stove, and we had a giant corn feast. They went out and picked their own corn, shucked it, and ate it. And from seed to feast was the most extraordinary farm-to-table party I've ever attended.
With agritourism, the way it is on farms, most kids go through corn mazes, not really realizing that that's where the corn that they eat comes from, and most of our diets, as you know, have quite a bit of corn in it.
Right.
So this was a chance where they could walk through those real tall stalks of corn and grab hold of an ear after learning the science of how the corn was fertilized and how it grows. They would learn how to tell when it was ripe enough by what it looked like and how it felt, and they would grab it and break it off and then shuck it. They learned a new word, shucking corn, and they saw all those kernels on the inside, and then they learned how to cook it and eat it.
The North Shore Child and Family Guidance Center has two physical centers in lovely buildings, one in Roslyn and one in Manhasset, where children go for therapy sessions. And because of the success here, we were invited to build gardens on their lawns, and so gardening is now integrated into their therapy program as well, right on site, and their parents who bring them can work together with the children as they're coming and leaving to see how vegetables grow.
Wow.
I can send you a link to a video that was just on My Long Island. They did a feature on the garden at the center in Manhasset, which serves preschoolers to about third grade. And there's some interesting comments that some of the kids made. One said that what I've learned from the garden is that big things can grow from a small seed. And I think that's a tremendous awareness, because any social change starts with a small effort.
Well, like both of you, I have to say, both of you, your efforts.
If a child sees that in concrete form, it's easy to then metaphorically apply it to life. Their actions are seeds. They can in fact grow and change and blossom as well.
Yes, and your seeds, both of you, have been tremendous. I mean, what you have given back to the community is so huge, and on behalf of everyone in our community, I'm able to benefit from some of your energy, and I just want to thank you. You're doing tremendous work, and unfortunately we're out of time, so just really quickly, can you share your website so people can get in touch with you? And of course I'll post it on my website as well.
LICAN.org, foxhollowfarm.com, and storyarts.org.
Thank you, and I'll share it on my website. Thank you, everybody, for joining us this week, and I'll be with you again next week. Have a great rest of the week. Bye for now.